Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio.
The Donald on the Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888.
Welcome to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Puskintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames, Iowa, the center of everything. And we talk every week about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. We kind of cover a lot of stuff. So Donna. I saw something yesterday that I haven't seen in a long, long time.
Well, what was that, Lana?
An umbrella.
I don't think we got that much rain, but we got some rain.
Enough for an umbrella.
The nice part was the air smelled like rain. Oh, it felt so good. Hopefully there'll be a little more of that.
It has been dry here in central Iowa. It's trying to be spring, but it's going from the hot to the cold. Dry, 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 hot, cold, and windy. My goodness, windy. Yeah. Oh, sign of spring. Last Saturday, the first downtown Ames Farmers Market was there, and it was a fine turnout. I think we're finally coming out from under our COVID rocks a little bit.
Oh yeah, and I hope we appreciate it. And no, I mean, like, I've forgotten how to behave in public. Probably.
It felt so good. And Donna, first asparagus. I got the first asparagus from a farmer from a place called Stargrass Farms,
oh,
and
he's by
Maxwell, Iowa, and boy, did I ever enjoy the first asparagus.
Yeah, well, there's not much other produce right at the moment, but it will come.
It'll come, and people were there ready to visit, to and food trucks and all that sort of thing.
Flowers.
Oh, and plants. Huh? Start thinking about your garden.
Yeah, Beth was there. Elizabella Flora or something?
Yeah. Oh, it was good. People and dogs, of course. Dogs are big at farmers market. So, it's the season.
Wait, I have a question.
Yeah.
Are you not selling at farmers market at all this year?
You will not find Onion Creek Farm at farmers market. We are doing other things, including there are CSAs, community supported agricultures, that you might want to be thinking about this time of year. And we will be part of the Farm to Folk community supported agriculture. Look that up. Farm
to Folk. And where will you sell your garlic when it comes in a month or two?
Farm to Folk, or contact us.
But okay.
It's awful dry. I don't know how big that stuff's going to be this year, folks. We'll have to see what the summer brings. Well, I mentioned asparagus. And another thing this time of year, rhubarb is showing its brave head. Despite the strange dry weather, the rhubarb is coming up.
Well, there's that old saying, you don't think the rain will hurt the rhubarb, do you?
Did they say that?
Yeah, that's an old one.
They say that.
old New England one. But obviously this year, there's not enough rain to hurt the rhubarb. So.
Oh, no, for goodness sakes. Oh, anyway, it is a sign of spring. And we are going to rerun a little gem from the Donna Lana Kitchen Archives. I think we're calling it Rhubarb Revisited. This little bit on, and it, Donna and I think, covered just about all the basics of rhubarb in this little thing. And it originally was from a Donna Lana Kitchen show way back in May 2016. Can you believe we haven't been on the air that long? But the rhubarb,
we've been on longer than that.
I know we have.
Oh, we're so old.
Oh, we're so old. But it's a good one. It's a good one. So let's listen to this bit of Rhubarb Revisited.
There is who remembers? Gildy probably remembers this. There was a band called Silly Wizard.
along about the 70s and 80s. And there was some singers in there that would kind of revive old English tunes. And they had a series of things about kind of music that people would sing on the streets to hawk their wares. And this is one of them.
Are you going to tell me you have a Rhubarb Sellers song?
There's this thing that is stuck in my head ever since rhubarb came up as a topic this week. And here's how it goes. And this one connects up rhubarb to the country of Turkey, because you'll find out. It goes like this. Turkey rhubarb, turkey rhubarb, turkey rhubarb I sell. I come here from Turkey to make you all well. Oh, don't you know me? My name it is Sam, 'cause I am the celebrated turkey rhubarb man. Huh? That's the kind of thing that you'd sing if you were trying to gather up business. So that one attributes rhubarb to the turkey rhubarb man, but it also does allude to the fact that it is medicinal. We need a lot of extra oomph in the spring,
yep,
and rhubarb
spring cleaning.
Isn't. Yeah.
Now the thing is, rhubarb is, I don't know why it's a turkey rhubarb, because it's actually a northern plant. I mean, it takes cold weather.
Well,
you don't eat rhubarb usually in Mediterranean cuisine.
Well, Turkey's way up there. They've got like mountains where apples and stuff come from too. So yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, he was probably a middleman anyway. Who knows? Sam the turkey rhubarb man. I don't know.
Well, the usual things with rhubarb, as we all know, it goes quite well with cinnamon. The traditional one that I grew up with, of course, is nutmeg, and a little nutmeg in the rhubarb with sugar. Of course, everybody loves strawberries with it, but citrus is really good. Orange and rhubarb are one of my favorites.
Oh, I discovered a wonderful combination, rhubarb and orange marmalade. Huh?
She makes a good one.
Now, that's the kind of thing to make this time of year. You have to slice the oranges and boil them in sugar water, kind of
With the skins on,
until the slices are translucent, and then you can
go on. Marmalade,
yeah. And then you can kind of go on. But that combination, just rhubarb by itself is kind of, it's rather assertive. And the orange sort of helps. Yes, it is. And we have on the Donalana Kitchen website, there is a page of recipes there. And one of the first recipes we put up way back, it was about 2014, maybe?
Yes, we're always, this time of year, we have to do rhubarb.
Yeah, well, there's a recipe there called Bernice's Really Good Rhubarb Dessert. And Bernice Donovan is not with us anymore, but a fine woman who lived here in Ames. And check out that Really Good Rhubarb
Now, you know, rhubarb is also good for savory things, too.
Who would have thought?
Something that, you know, you need a little tang. I did run across a rhubarb bacon compote recipe.
Bacon.
Which includes bacon, onion, rhubarb, maple syrup, because, of course, it's very tart, red wine vinegar, a little allspice, and a little thyme. I think I might even try to make that.
Oh, what does one put with that? Does that
compote? Yeah. Oh, well, you could, something like this, you could serve it on chicken, or you could even put it on toast, or, you know, it's a, instead of ketchup kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
It's got that sweet sour tang thing to it.
We talked about ketchup on a past show, and there are other things to eat besides ketchup. There are other food enhancers, fun little things. That sounds good. Yes. Good.
Oh, you know, the other thing, I think we did this last summer, so we may have talked about it, making rhubarb syrup. So you're going to take your rhubarb and chop it up with some water, and then you're going to cook it slowly for as long as 2 hours. Just make sure it has plenty of water. And then eventually you kind of strain the rhubarby out of it, and you've got very strongly flavored liquid to which you add syrup. Then you've got rhubarb syrup. You could use it in cocktails. I mean, a good thing would be like a little in the summer Prosecco with rhubarbs, or champagne, or white wine with rhubarb syrup. That would be an easy one. Or it makes a lovely addition to lemonade,
or instead of lemonade, with just, you know, adding water and, you know, because the rhubarb is the sour. So you could just add bubbly water and the rhubarb and have a rhubarb soda, a rhubarb fizz, as it were.
So all that stuff growing
and
up there.
Then you put a little gin in it.
Have at it. Have at it, yes. All that rhubarb growing out there.
Oh, also, you know, rhubarb, don't you freeze it. I this time of year when we get a lot of it, it's so easy to freeze. I just chop it up. I don't blanch it. I don't do anything. I just chop it up, put it in freezer bags, and in she goes.
Yes. So plan on enjoying that rhubarb. Well, I hope you are all inspired with thoughts of rhubarb. Let thoughts of rhubarb dance in your head this week. You had another addendum.
One more rhubarb pointer. So my friends Paula Herrera and Gio Chiclase do a lot of Georgian cooking, and because Gio is Georgian, and they have this traditional recipe which they really try and replicate over here. And it's some kind of a beef stew. It's traditionally made with a sour plum. Now, the sour plum is not available around here, whatever that variety is. So they have substituted rhubarb for that. So that sourness of rhubarb stands in for the sour plum. Another thing it would probably also replace is tamarind, which is another very sour fruit. So if you think of recipes that use either and lemon, all of the sour fruits, rhubarb can be, you know, I mean, if you think about, for example, probably when my grandmother was a child and they didn't have access to many lemons and things like that.
Or tamarind,
right? Rhubarb was a really good souring agent for lots of foods. So rhubarb, we could be more expansive in our use of rhubarb, and it is ubiquitous right now and yummy and fresh and spring-like.
Very good. Very good. Well, Donna and I have been reading a book called, reading a book called Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal by author Mark Bittman. So we'll talk about how we eat and what we're doing to the planet. It is not always a pretty picture. Take it away, Donna.
Well, I'm going to just say, Mark covers, this is really a historical book. Yeah. He goes right from the beginning of agriculture, but he really recounts a lot of, there are many, many chapters of American agriculture, of course. And I have to say that recent history, you know, like from maybe our grandmothers, this happens in history a lot. As soon as a generation dies, whatever they went through, it's not enough to be in the history books yet. And, you know, we're still grappling with the meanings of these things. So we often forget what recent history is like. But the thing with that is recent history is often the most informative for present issues. So this is a good book for this. But I have to say, when it first came out, I bought it because, you know, I knew it was going to be an important book. And I got it and I sort of sat on it and grimaced a lot. And because in my professional life, there have been instances where I have rubbed shoulders with Mark Bittman, the author, and I did not appreciate his personality. He's very New York. Okay. That's okay. But he's also just full of himself, as we would say.
Full of himself.
Right. So I have a sort of an attitude about Mark Bittman. And, and then I'm reading it and going, let me tell you his history. Okay. Mark Bittman has been a New York Times food writer for quite a number of years. A lot of recipes. He wrote a whole book, major book, How to Cook Everything, I think, was one of his big successes.
He would have a title.
Yeah, Everything. and then, so he wrote in the New York Times a lot covering food and recipes and things for a long time. Then in the last, I don't know, somewhere 5 to 10 years, he started writing a little bit more about the politics of food. And I have to give it to him. He is a very good writer, okay, and a good thinker. And so his political pieces were they're always spot on. I certainly don't disagree with him. And I was really glad that he was contributing a little bit more thoughtfully to food systems. And, you know, but he still has his reputation as a food writer, like another book. And we've talked about this on a show, and maybe this was, I don't know, 3 or 4 years old, is called VB6. And it means vegan before six. And what he's saying in that book, that came after How to Cook Everything, right? It's a smaller book. He, as a food professional in New York, and he's, you know, I don't know, he's got to be in his 60s somewhere or something. He's not a young pup anymore, to be full of himself. But he was finding that, you know, as a food critic and food writer and cooking expert, he was putting on some weight. So he determined a way for him to deal with this was to actually make all of his food before 6 o'clock completely vegan, which is an excellent way to do it. You know, it's a way of dieting and kind of, and he uses it as a way to explore more vegan options. And I thought it was a really another clever idea from Mark Bittman, right? And I think we recommended the book on the show because as a professional, he still needed to be taste everything, you know, and you can't like just become a vegan and still be taken seriously in the restaurant and food world because there's too much you have to taste and count on and comment on. Mm-hmm. And it's still, even though veganism is definitely growing, it's not the complete mainstream here. So his solution was to be a part-time vegan, which as Lana and I always recommend, eating less meat and more vegetables and grains is always a good idea for everyone, however you balance that out. So anyway, this new book comes along and I order it and I'm like gritting my teeth because, you know, I'm thinking it covers all of the issues that I have basically spent my professional life dealing with and caring about. And I'm thinking, okay, Mr. Mark Bittman, why didn't you write this book 20 years ago? Because these are not new issues, right? And he does admit in his acknowledgement section that he sort of came late to the party. And I'm a little judgmental thinking, well, okay, if you're, because my position as a chef has always been, okay, whatever your occupation is in life or your preoccupation, it is your kind of ethical obligation to basically like examine the upstream and the downstream of your industry. Like where, if you're a food writer, where is your food coming from? What does agriculture mean? And then of course, what are the consequences of eating the standard American diet? And, you know, as a chef, I came to that table pretty early on and it has always been my voice to, you know, talk about these issues in the professional circles that I was in. So I was kind of like, okay, Mr. Bittman, you know you're really brilliant, but why did it take so long? So I sat on the fence about this book until I finally, there were some reviews from people that I care about. And I thought, all right, I better read the damn thing. So actually I gave it to Lana.
See, yeah, thanks. Now I love history. I love overviews. And yeah. This is a great book.
This is a history book.
To learn about food, how food turned from how we feed ourselves to a commodity, how we feed ourselves to ways for people to make money in this last century. And he does a really good job. I mean, this is a huge scope. And I even mentioned to Donna when I handed this book back to her, well, I learned a whole lot, but I get kind of sick of Mr. Mittman's mansplaining things.
Yes, it is a bit of that.
But get past that because it's a good book to, I kind of barrel well,
he
through
does,
it.
He does explain things very well. He has a way with words, his oversight. And he starts at the beginning of agricultural history. I like to do this when we're reviewing books. I'm going to read you a little. So remember the title is, very clever title, of course, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. So here are the table of contents. Part one, the birth of growing, the brain feedback loop, soil and civilization, agriculture goes global, creating famine. He's quite political about this and in my book, correct. I did not find a single thing that I thought was a misstep in here, really. Part two is the 20th century. Now, this, I think, I wish everyone in Iowa would read part two, because Iowa is the 20th century of farming and how we got here at the, you know, the 19th and the 20th century really shaped, you know, what we consider Iowa, right?
I wish to back up a little bit to this first part, the birth of growing, because you think about this, but think, oh, nobody's ever researched this, but he did. This section called Creating Famine. You wonder why, you know, the Roman Empire and the breadbasket of and the Mesopotamian area and Egypt. Why, how did these big civilizations feed everybody? And why are things kind of barren looking now? If you look at
certain places,
And you know, you just can't keep taking. And it is a really good historical look at why things are happening. And even up to the present day, why people are moving away from their home countries. You don't move away because the Taco Bell is better in the United States. No, you
Taco really, Bell is the same everywhere. That's true.
So, but really, truly, if there is a famine, if there is a drought,
the Syrian migration,
they're very good. Anyway, this way that he kind of touches on everything, and it's good reading. Like I say, it's not a pretty picture, but I think all of us as Iowans and consumers of food kind of take this overview and helps us understand why we are where we are right now. Because all this stuff, we found this new world to over grab from, overproduce.
Yeah, All of this new research there is not new. Right. Some of the details, of course, are new, but the inventiveness of it and where the land grant colleges came from and why they were formed. And so the second part is called the 20th century, and the chapters are farm as factory. And then he talks about the Dust Bowl, and then food and branding, then soy, chicken, and cholesterol, force feeding junk, and the so-called Green Revolution. Then the third part, he calls change. The resistance is one chapter where we're at. And then there is finally the way forward. So it does, you know, it's a very good history of farming, and particularly, okay, since we are in the belly of the beast here, and since we have all grown up with farmers must feed the world. And, you know, now there's some question about is what we're growing in Iowa actually feeding the world. And he explains why that slogan is maybe not quite so accurate. I'm going to read just this little bit. This is from The American Way of Farming, which is chapter 5. He starts out with a sentence: food drives history and soil drives food. As industrial agriculture developed, it demanded more and more of the soil. That meant fertilizer. Until the 20th century, almost always in the form of human or animal waste, was in higher demand than ever. So he goes into this long history of why all of the white northern Europeans emigrated to this country and were given land.
Given
basically very cheaply in the Homesteading Act. You know, how they chased off the Indians, of course, unfortunately, and had this, quote, pristine prairie. And then John Deere came along and invented a certain kind of plow blade that was good at sod busting. And what all of this has meant, how this built up to what we have right now. So there's a lot in here about fertilizer, which is really interesting, because we forget that the nitrogen fertilizer, which actually draws the nitrogen from the air, was a fairly recent innovation in human history. And of course, the fertility of the land is limited by, you know, not NKP, as we say, nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. There we go. So here's a little bit. He says, a form of potash had been mined in Ethiopia since the 14th century, and bone meal was in such high demand that the remains of soldiers at Waterloo and other major battles were sold, ground, and resold, mostly in England. Whoa, now that's a little bit I didn't really realize. So his history is pretty complicated. He said, largely science, in quotation marks, has emerged not so much as a tool for understanding how to farm, but as a framework for contorting nature into shapes that squeezed out the most profit.
That kind of sums it up.
This is where he is leading into how the land grant institutions were established. You know, starting with Abraham Lincoln chasing off the, you know, I mean, we all love to love Lincoln, but, you know, he basically chased off the Indians and brought in the white settlers to set up the agriculture that we have right now. He also has another two paragraphs later, a statement that I really, hardly anyone ever says this, but I really believe this is true. He says, "It's unlikely that anyone or anything, not even the world's most powerful computers or scientists, will ever fully analyze the interactions that make healthy soil."
Ha.
Now, this I really, you know, this is coming up right now as the USDA is wanting to give carbon credits to farmers, and, you know, it all sounds good and carbon sinks and blah, 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 blah. The problem with that is the science of carbon sequestration in the soil is absolutely not understood completely and not actually reliably quantifiable. So here we are leaping into this government policy, encouraging farmers to do things that are probably good for them anyway, no problem, because even if you're building soil like that, it's always a good thing. After all, the soil is the farmer's capital, and it would help retain more water if we're going to have a drought. It makes less erosion. It creates less nitrogen run. All those things are really good. However, with the USDA leaping into commoditizing it and incentivizing it so that farmers are paid to do that, there really is no way to quantify it. You know,
right.
It's like the science and the math isn't there yet, folks. So it's a little topsy turvy. Anyway, Mark goes
let's,
on.
Let's.
Oh, it's oh, time see, for a break. See, Go see, ahead. That, I'm on
as,
a rant.
As you can tell, Donna has lots to say.
Donna gets
this.
Wound
and
up
yeah,
about these
we're
going to
come
right.
back and talk about this book about animal vegetable junk by Mark Bittman. But first, we're going to remind you this is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a tune called Speed the Plow. We're talking about agriculture today, and Speed the Plow, hey, this sounds like a good idea, but we're finding out it's not only good for farmers, but other people like John Deere made a heck of a lot of money out of Speed the Plow, and we're talking
and
about...
And yeah. Bittman says that Deere makes, they make money off the plow, but where they really made the most money was financing the implements to sell to the farmers.
Ha! It's pretty complicated, folks. We're talking about food coming from starting out as something to feed us into commodities. Everything kind of turns into big money.
You got to think of John Deere as a bank.
Oh, dear. It is. Okay. You've got more to say about this book. Go ahead, Donna.
Well, I was going to, we did see something. This led to part of the conversation. A new study from researchers at Tufts University says that according to the USDA, the diets of Americans from 2003 to 2018 found that school meals are the healthiest source of food. Researchers analyzed food from four sources: restaurants, grocery stores, schools, and others. Now, grocery stores included home cooking. And so home cooking is under grocery stores, and under that category, ranked at 33% poor quality for adults and 45% poor quality for children. So it's not what people, the average person, is even having in their home. It's what's going on in the school meals that is giving the healthiness. They use two metrics: the American Health Association diet score and the Healthy Eating Index. So it finds out that actually the meals that are being fed, and Biden is launching into a new program of, I think, everybody's getting a free meal at school or something, and they're talking about expanding it. Anyway, this is apparently a good bang for our buck, according to the USDA. And this is because... And I'm not going to remember the year, but golly, around 2006, maybe, we instituted on a national level, there was a requirement that every school system had to analyze the nutrition in their cafeterias and submit a plan to improve it. And there were standards, like you had to reduce sugar, you had to increase whole grains. A lot of them had to bring in salad bars. And I, at the time, worked in several, like in Kansas and in Iowa as well, with several school, like elementary and high school systems that were trying to make this changeover. Like the people running the school systems are going, well, how do we do this? Okay, whole grain hamburger buns. Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. The consensus that I heard from all of the public school meal program people was, well, the kids are not going to eat this. You know, it was like, and initially there was, of course, resistance. And, you know, they said, oh, we're finding that, you know, the kids are just throwing this in the garbage can, and really all they want is hot dogs and pizza and stuff like this. And Alice Waters in California had pioneered this thing in the Berkeley school system, she started by introducing gardens, school gardens. And this was from the Shea Panisse Foundation and the school gardens in Berkeley. And, you know, they taught math through the gardens and chemistry and biology. And then once she established the school gardening program, she brought in this other chef that I also know named Ann Cooper to then upgrade the qualities of the meals using some of the produce from the school gardens, and Ann Cooper came into the system about the time that the USDA was mandating these changes. She led it a little, she set the standards with Alice Waters for these things of how to do it. But the secret to that program and the success of it was that what they were doing is teaching the children in the classroom first. Oh, this is a cherry tomato. Look how it's grown. You grow one, you pick it, you eat it. So what I was seeing in my work in transforming the school systems into You can't just serve the stuff. You need to acquaint. It's part of the education. The children, as well as the adults, need to see the food, to taste the food, to learn about it. And then, so now we see in 2021 that actually, nutritionally, this has become the best food options. And it's unfortunate that this is the only thing you have to go to school to get a good meal. However, that imposition of federal regulations into nutritional standards in schools has caused a major change. Now, it took more than 10 years, but here we are, folks. It's quantifiable that this is now the healthiest food meal that many children get.
It's amazing. I enjoyed parts of the book that was written by Mark Bittman about why we eat the foods we do and how things change. And, well, heaven knows how much more sugar we eat now and salt and fats. But still, there are reasons that the USDA and university extension agents and home economists were invented. It wasn't so much to help the farmers grow food. It was how to market this stuff. How can we monetize.
That.
And one of the things, and it's even something people say even now, the greatest thing since sliced bread. Oh, the greatest. Because remember we can't even remember what bread used to be, because bread used to be baked by people in ovens and baked.
Before my time and Lana's time.
Yeah.
Lana and I I grew up with Wonder Bread.
Sliced bread. The greatest thing. Because it was interesting. As the Industrial Revolution kind of changed the American landscape and the economy's changed, society's changes, there were less and less people that could afford a cook, could afford servants. And all of a sudden, women in the home were faced with this dilemma. Housework? Kitchens? Oh, my goodness, I don't have time to do any of that sort of stuff. And besides, it's kind of low class to cook. And
well,
it's a lot of work.
When more women, I mean, I grew up with a working mother. Now, that was not common when I was a child. But now almost all women work and they don't have time to bake bread.
That's true. And so, but that bread
changed. Except for fun.
That bread changed. More white bread. It soon became the fact that people were eating this white mushy stuff you mentioned, Wonder Bread, but that was a high class way to do it. And here is a bit of trivia, and I found this by listening to a concert of a Scottish country dance music at last weekend. It's a long story, but anyway, one of the people in the chat room threw out a bit of trivia and said, "What is Chillicothe, Missouri, known for?" And the answer is, in 1928, it was the home of the invention of the machine that made sliced bread. So 1928, and that was important because this white bread that was being mass produced was too soft to cut.
It has a lot of air.
A lot of air.
Air is free.
And people
still
kind of complaining. Of course, we had to use our county extension agents and our home economists to kind of warn people that now bread was going to be sliced and in bags. But see, we learn new things. And that's
was 1928.
Oh,
so
the history of food. Really, really interesting. Yes, it is.
Yeah, so in the Mark Bittman book, there are like, for example, in the chapter called Where We're At, he has this nice little table, which explains quite clearly things that we've talked about. He lists desirable foods, optional foods, and undesirable foods. Under desirable, he said, rely on to whatever extent possible. Okay, vegetables, fruits, whole grains. That's whole grains, not white flour, right? Legumes, eat your beans and lentils, nuts, seeds, and water. The optional foods are fats extracted from vegetables, seeds, nuts, and fruits, which would be olive oil and things like that. Optional is meat. Optional is dairy. Optional is seafood. Optional is eggs. Coffee, tea, and alcohol. He puts debatable after alcohol. Okay. All right. I'm in total agreement with these. Then under undesirable, stay away from as much as possible. Ultra processed foods, including chemically extracted oils, sugars, flours, etc. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there's your white flour, and a lot of the common vegetable oils that you buy in supermarkets, if it says vegetable oil, that's, I don't use them. Okay. I like to have, I basically use olive oil and some canola, coconut oil, but
and butter's good.
Butter, yes, but that would be under the dairy. And then junk foods, sweets, etc., and sweetened vegetables, beverages. Sorry, sweetened beverages. Now, this is another political thing that's been controversial in the last year, where states or cities are enacting soda taxes, and things like that. And that is another way to move public policy for its own good, just like the school lunch program. You know, one of the simplest things that people can do to make their diet healthy is switch from drinking, you know, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, all of the sweetened sodas,
the big slurpy things.
Yeah, any of those. And like in our household, we've completely replaced them with like flavored seltzers. There's no sugar at all in that. Of course, you can always drink water, or you can have a glass of water with some lemon juice in it or some rhubarb juice in it.
Because right? I don't remember the exact numbers, but kind of stretch your brain to envision all the Iowa corn and soybean fields, especially the corn fields. There's a lot of them. And we think, oh, we are feeding the world. However, a big chunk of all that corn not only goes to feed animals, but two big things that Iowa is producing, and we don't like to brag about this, we are producing high fructose corn syrup and ethanol. Yeah, this is kind of far from food.
Well, we'll fight for our ethanol subsidies, probably.
Yeah, but a different thing, yeah.
The high fructose corn syrup lobby is not noticed very much.
Well, anyway, this is KHOI, and you're listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking about a book by Mark Bittman called Animal Vegetable Junk. And you can find out more about this Donalana Kitchen show at www.khoifm.org and find out more about all this fine radio station has to offer. We're back. This is the Donalana Kitchen, and we're talking about the history of food. It's kind of a big thing to bite off, Donna, but we are,
we'll chew on this for a while.
Well, it's good because you realize that it's turned into big business, and big business is not necessarily about nutrition or family farms or communities. Big business is about big business. Yes, it is.
So in Mark Bittman's book, Animal Vegetable Junk, he has a chapter at the end of the book called Conclusions. And I'm going to read this paragraph because it says a lot about it. And I have to say, it is a recent history book. He covers COVID-19 in it. He covers a lot of the issues that are coming up now at the USDA about Black farmer restitution and a lot of the racism that was inherent in the agricultural history completely of the United States and mostly globally.
And refugees, huh?
Yeah.
It all comes down to the same cloth, right?
So, okay, here is a closing paragraph. Innovation from industry is not going to fix food and diet, and neither is buying right. Like, we can't shop our way out of this. Okay. Both patches are on a tire with no tread. The system itself needs to be changed, its values and goals challenged and reimagined. We need legislation to support agriculture that stewards the land. We need food processing whose goal is to nourish. And we need an economy that supports people who want to grow and cook food for their communities. Those will come about when citizens organize and force government to do its job. A good diet will follow. All right. Us citizen eaters, we got our work cut out for us as usual.
Yes, it is.
So this is a highly recommended read so we can be informed eaters. Yes.
Oh, I want to mention, I'm a very visual person. The cover of this book is quite telling. It has a lovely, a still life, a collection of past eating utensils through the ages, a two-tined fork and a real fancy looking knife and a very antiquated spoon. And way at the bottom, under the word junk, it kind of sums up our century. It shows a spork.
A plastic spork.
I want to leave us with a little thought from Aldo Leopold. I came across a bit of his writings from a book called For the Health of the Land, previously unpublished essays of Aldo Leopold. And this is one of his from 1939. It's called Farmer as a Conservationist. I want to read just a few lines here from Aldo Leopold. Conservation means harmony between men and land. When land does well for its owner, the owner does well by the land. When both end up better by reason of their partnership, we have conservation. When one or the other grows poorer, we do not. What is the nature of the process by which men destroy land? We've talked about the extraction that has been going on through the centuries. What is the nature of that process by which men destroy land? What kind of events make it possible for that much quoted old timer to say, "You can't tell me about farming. I've worn out three farms already, and this is my fourth." So we kind of discussed the American way of farming, and unfortunately, that's been it. And we've come to a time in our existence, well, we don't have much more to deplete. There's a lot of
kind of covered the planet already.
Yeah,
we're running out of farmable land to mine and deplete.
And don't think that it's not just that backyard garden of yours. There are thousands of people that are starving because their land is blowing away. They cannot feed themselves. And no, it's not terrorists, and it's not people that are just too lazy. They're moving because they cannot grow. They cannot feed themselves.
Just like in the Dust Bowl.
It happened to us too.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it does. And just like the Dust Bowl, we did learn a few things, not a lot, but we learned a few things from that. And because there's so many of us, we do have to rely on politics and how we work together.
Well, and the thing about the Dust Bowl, okay, that happened not in my lifetime. So let's hope we don't have to relearn the same lessons. So know your history. And Mark Bittman has given us a good history book on food.
On food.
Yeah. Food and farming.
That's Mark Bittman, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. And it just kind of get by his tone of voice. Just because Donna's met him and he's
But he is an entertaining writer. I sat down with a really bad attitude toward the book and I couldn't put it down. Okay. Cause it does move right along and he's insightful and, you know, it is. History books can be well written
and insightful too, because we all have to eat. And let's start thinking about where all that comes from. It affects every type of life.
Speaking of eating. Tomorrow is Cinco de Mayo.
Oh,
taco time.
That sounds great. So happy Cinco de Mayo tomorrow. Yes. And here we're kind of sliding into the upcoming events. Mother's Day is coming up this coming weekend.
Yes, another eating occasion.
Oh, Donna, we eat for everything.
Eat with your mother.
Yes, yes. Take her something nice. Yes. Mother's Day coming up, and just in time on Onion Creek Farm, where I have onion, my farm is called Onion Creek Farm. We had triplet lambs born yesterday. So we're thinking of mothers and lambs and, well, actually,
and
we're thinking
spring,
of
spring. Yeah, right.
And oh, and lamb so chops. And oh, they're cute. Now, it's tricky because we have a mother with a nice bag of milk, but she has two teats, a T-E-A-T-A-S-S, teats, and there are three lambs so far.
They're sharing nicely?
So far, they're sharing. We may turn into a hassle. Again, it's all about supply and demand.
Yeah. Well, you might be getting out the bottle.
Okay. Anyway, lambs this time of year. And here's some more upcoming events. The Story County Conservation Organization, which has events here in town, is offering to ask people out to help weed out of the woods, pull garlic
in public parks,
to pull garlic mustard and cut honeysuckle. And that will happen at various locations on Wednesdays. Weeding out Wednesdays. There we go.
I hope they're bringing in the goats for the honeysuckle.
Oh, that'd be good. Yeah. So weekends in May, think of getting outside and doing something.
It will take a lot of people to get out there to get rid of the garlic mustard and the honeysuckle.
You can make a dent. So think of making a dent.
It is very invasive. Now, you can eat that garlic mustard this time of year, as a matter of fact. It's very good in salads. You could saute it. You could drop it in soup. But there's a lot of it out there.
It is. Garlic and honeysuckle. Honeysuckle is a woody growth that is not native here, and it takes over things. So, yes, it's not a bad thing to get rid of. And that's a bit more, as they say, doable.
It's brushy, as they would say. Clear out that brush.
Oh, brushy. Good. The Story County Conservation also has other things coming up every Wednesday, late in April through May. There's the geocaching. I've never done that.
What?
Geocaching. You learn how to use your GPS stuff. They kind of make like a treasure hunt. They hide things around and give hints and but get you to walk through the woods.
You're not using a compass anymore.
I don't know. Are you
using your phone to do this?
We're new pioneers, I guess.
Okay.
And there's things on birds. And
bird day hikes. Now that sounds like something I'd like.
Poinsettia at McFarland Park. Insectology at Tedesco Environmental Learning Center. And nature detectives at Hickory Grove Park, designed for kindergarten kids. That's pretty good.
So that's all at where's Story County Conservation?
Story County Conservation.
Okay.
Yes. You can Google Story County Conservation. They have lots of good stuff. And there's a lot of, you look around Iowa and think, we don't have a lot of fancy parks and big national forests or anything, but there's a lot of little.
Well, Ames has a really, I think for the size of town that we have, I think we have a very elaborate, well-maintained park system. Yes. That's one of the three things I love about our little town.
Let's get out there. Yes, it is. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen.
Oh, what about the concert coming
up? Oh, we have another upcoming.
We have a KHOI fundraiser.
KHOI fundraiser is happening. KHOI presents Chad Elliott and Bo Ramsey at Stevens Auditorium, May 9th, 5 p.m., in a benefit concert for our community radio station. You can go and hear them live, concert hall tickets, or buy live streaming tickets to watch from home, and safety protocols will be all taken care of. So you can actually go among human beings and see live people playing music. And Chad Elliott and Bo Ramsey are fantastic. Thanks to Chad Elliott and Bo Ramsey and the CY Stevens Auditorium for co-sponsoring the event, and also funding from Ames Commission on the Arts. I want to mention that this is community radio. This is the Donalana Kitchen. And we've had music today by the Barn Owl Band. We heard some good stuff, good dance tunes, and we'll go out with a tune called The Sunday River Waltz. My name is Lana Noctico.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Engineering by Mike Murphy. Thank you, Mike. Eat good food and enjoy life.